Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you today?
I'm wonderful, Sal. How about yourself?
Outstanding.
Who you got for us?
Well, we have a returning guest, Miss Sarah Beth Aubrey. How are you, Sarah?
Well, I'm very good. I'm glad to return and very glad to be called a special guest, Sal.
Special guest. Thank you. That's right. But before we get started, and you've got quite the introductions, and I want to do it justice, but before we get started, we always start with the question of the day. And this one for a farm girl, this one's easy. What is one ag myth that you wish that you could bust forever?
Well, I love these questions today. When I listen to your podcast, I get a kick out of these. And I know a lot of your hosts and guests have pretty pithy responses.
Yes,
you like a little bit of flavor with this. So I thought about it and thought I have a really serious, deep answer. And then I changed my mind.
Oh, no. Well, we're going to have both of them now.
Okay. Well, we'll get into some good quality stuff, but this right. I'm just going to start with. But I will bring it back home to you, Sal, at some point in the conversation. So, Jeff, this is for you. Ag myth that we need to bust forever is that cowboys do love wine and cheese.
Really?
There you go.
And
mostly because Sarah has introduced us to wine and cheese parties in every national show in the country at her stalls.
I have. Yes, I have. I think I have personally busted this myth and tried very hard to continue, informing the farming public and particularly the livestock showing public how to have some couth and class at those events.
There you go.
So we can talk more about it, but there's the myth, and we've busted it, Sal.
Okay. I can't dispute that, but I would wonder if there's any noise in the data. Did you offer them anything else?
Well, frankly, everyone offers them anything else. So I offered them a different alternative, and I think that's what I wanted to tie throughout this and seem. So we used to go to a lot of these national shows. Everybody stands around, has different kinds of fair food, if you will, and I wanted a different marketing approach to bring customers to our stalls, and I wanted to do it differently, and so I decided to put out cheese and wine and use real glasses at a show, and a lot of people, including some present company, thought that might be a strange approach to lure cattle spenders to the stalls.
Yeah.
But as it turned out, we had success with it. And in fact, a few of the bigger breeders in the barn at one point several years back even commented that, you know, we really like wine and cheese. So the point of this and the through line for our chat today, Sal, I promise you I'd tie it back, is that, you know, when you got to differentiate yourself in an ag business where it's all margins and we're very similar and we understand our business so deeply, if you aren't trying to be a little different with your approach, you're just going to blend in with the crowd.
That's well said.
And it did work. In fact, a lot of those people that used to come to the wine cheese parties started to expect it. So Sarah had like big expectations, but she showed up. It's like, cool, when's the party?
Yes.
Fun times.
Well, Jeff, what myth do you want to bust?
Mine kind of goes along a similar route. It's not really just a single topic myth, but it's that myth in general that farmers are just hicks that, you know, wake up and slop the pigs and milk the cows and gather the eggs every morning. And I would like to bust that myth, you know, where the non-ag public can see that, you know, all the space age technology that we use and stuff. So just to get away from this, similar to what Sarah was talking about.
Yep. Very good. I think mine is kind of along the same lines. And you guys will know what I'm talking about as soon as I bring it up. But have you ever seen the commercial where the farmer is driving down the side of the field with an old 1958 pickup truck, and he's got a bushel basket of some kind of produce that he's pulling out of the soybean field? And I'm like, you know, that's the exact wrong message that we need to send about agriculture, because that's not agriculture, right?
Did he have a dog named Old Buck sitting in the truck?
Right?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he did.
And he's collecting his harvest in this bushel basket, you know. And I think that's the commercial production agriculture is a good thing, and that's what makes everything roll and feeds the world. It's not, we don't do it in bushel baskets anymore.
No,
maybe in the garden, but that's about the only place. Well, good. Yeah. It sounds like we got some good myth busting going on, and
glad.
And got alcohol somehow in the podcast within the last first 4 minutes.
You got to support the wine farmers.
That's so, right. You know. The wine farmers. God. All right, Sarah Beth, well, welcome back. And I've got to just talk a little bit about, you've got a dual role. You are the CEO of the Envoy Group, right? And also the founder of Advocacy Coalitions. Can you tell us a little bit about both of those?
Sure. So I've been an entrepreneur and own businesses in the consulting space for 21 years. So Sal, the last day I ever had a job was anniversary just passed. November 10th, 2004 was my last day I worked for a company. And I've been building entrepreneurial ventures and consulting type businesses in agriculture and energy now for 21 years. So Envoy is really a very traditional consulting firm. I do a lot with, I call, leading boards and organizations through change. So we do peer groups. We facilitate a lot of meetings. We help organizations with team challenges. I do a lot of keynote speaking around that. We have some signature programs that we develop for helping organizations navigate their change and work through progress. We're now doing a lot of retreats, done for you corporate retreats for companies to take their take themselves out of the everyday and offline to really retreat and work together. And we're building those start to finish. So that's Envoy in a nutshell. We have some executive coaching in there too. There's 8 contractors that support me in that work. And we work all over North America and sometimes in Europe as well, mostly with speaking engagements I've had. Then advocacy is a play on words. We do say AG, so advocacy, a play on words with advocacy with an AD. A couple years ago, about 2021, started down that, realized it was a separate company, separated out. This is truly our grassroots coalitions work. So clients pay us to help them move a message, a challenge, a topic, a subject forward that they feel like needs to be talked about. We do that through a lot of events. We lead a lot of roundtables. We help clients host forums. We do messaging. Last week, we did a farmer press conference, really to gather farmers together online with the media to help share what they feel like the challenges are facing agriculture. So we'll do some things like that. And that one, we work mostly in Indiana with that group.
Very nice. Well, through all this, I mean, she has won a lot of awards. I just kind of looked up a couple of these, and certainly the Transformational Leadership Award was one of them that come right up, but the 2025 Smart Women in Meetings Entrepreneurial Award, which that fits right into you being the founder of the Advocacy Coalitions, and then also the Smart Meetings Innovator Award for Innovation and Event Planning. And I know this goes back to the kind of the climate discussion. We talked a little bit about sustainable agriculture last time that you were on. And then the Environmental Finance Award for North American Community Building Leadership and Ag Communicators of Tomorrow Distinguished Alumni Award. So you've certainly you've been busy.
I have. And you know, what's funny, a long time ago, well, not that long, but long enough ago, I won a 40 under 40 award. You know, I'm so proud of that. A friend's complimenting me on it. And he said, well, you know, Sarah, that's really nice. But the only thing left is those distinguished alumni awards when you get to a certain age. And now all of a sudden I just got one of those and it sort of stung, but it's nice to be acknowledged, Sal, no matter what.
you've got a women in agriculture, what do you call it? WISE. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Yep. Yes. So on that sustainability topic, and we can get into that topic if you want today, but that's really changed a lot. That definition is so broad and it's evolved a lot as well. But interestingly enough, the more work I started to do in that segment of agriculture since about 21, I realized that quite frankly, a lot of the individuals leading and doing the work, whether they're in the C-suite or they're in the practitioner role, were females. And I thought, you know, am I just noticing that because that's me, it's a mirror? Or is that true? So I started to research that, and I really started about the end of 23, early 24. And it turns out that that's not incorrect. Sustainability C-suite positions are held in the U.S. over 55% by women. And so are, you know, we graduate more young ladies from ag college today than young men at our Big Ten schools. Jeff would know that. He's brought more young ladies to the forefront than young men as well. So he's a great example. But so it's real interesting. And then even today in the work like you do at Premier, you know, you've got, you know, on the ground work, you've got a lot of agronomists, and a lot of women are going into the sustainable ag space, even in the agronomy work, which when I started as an ag chem rec in 1997, there were a few other gals out there, but not many. And that's just changed a ton in 30 years. And so couple that, Jeff, with the fact that sustainability roles, whatever they are, they're changing, they're emerging. They're usually brand new for a company. They usually have no precedence because no one's done it before. They usually have either limited resources, or some of the team agrees with it and some of the team doesn't. Some of the customers want it, some of them don't. So there's a lot of conflict in this, and then people don't have a peer. So having built peer groups for many years, I can recognize how valuable they are for individuals to uplevel themselves. And so that's really what the WISE is. It's a Women in Sustainability and Energy Network that we started. It's online, started this year for women all over, from anywhere. And we have two in-person events a year as well.
Very nice.
Are you introducing those women to wine and cheese at the same time, or?
I think we would. I would not. I would absolutely do that if asked. Yeah. And now that this is going to be on a broadcast, perhaps that will happen.
Well, I think you make a good point, because when I go back to Purdue in the fall for career fairs and stuff, you know, if you went back to, you know, some of those college recruiting visits that we did back in the early 90s and stuff, it was mostly guys. But today, it's mostly, you know, the gals that are coming through there, and they're sharp.
Yep.
They're sharp. And just the guys are going to have to step their game up, keep up with these gals. I guess so.
Yeah.
So
some will need to. Yes.
Let's stick on the sustainability thing, because I know when we were together here, I guess about 2.5 years ago, and that was one of the things that you wanted to get in front of, was just helping define that. And you went through a lot of the things that that companies struggle with, either in definition or prioritization or proportion or however you want to put it. But one of the things that we have seen is that, and maybe it's with the last election cycle and, you know, with the funding and who's going to pay and how do you staff for something if we're not sure about the revenue stream and how important it is to the end user. And that's a lot to say. What has happened in the last 2.5 years since?
Yeah, that is a lot to say. And all of that has happened.
Yeah.
Like, you've summed it up yourself. So when how I started on the sustainability topic was several years ago in 21, a group of organizations literally got together, and we were real narrow at the time. It was around the time of the carbon programs offered to growers starting to come out and starting to be available, but also confusing. And of course, our first question as growers and suppliers to growers was, well, how does this pay? Does this even pay? And so those ag groups came together, and me doing the work, as I've told you, I typically have done for a long time. It was like, well, somebody should do something. Sarah, if we throw some funds at this, would you put something together? And our original goal was so simple, Sal. It was, let's start talking about climate, sustainability, renewable energy, all these things that are coming to agriculture's doorstep. We need to be at least talking about what they are, how they're impacting our, you know, ag land, our farmers, suppliers. And we started with that and started some summits and things. But like you said, that has changed dramatically. We no longer need to bring awareness to this topic, whether it's an opportunity, a challenge, or even a conflict in the supply chain. All of those things are there today. We know about it. And we're in kind of the bottom of the curve. If you talk about the adaptation curve, you know, first you've got awareness of something. That's done. We know. Now we're in the mess where awareness is coupled with opportunity, conflict, challenge, change, scaling, relevancy, profitability. It's all there now. And it's, you know, we're certainly not to the adaptation place yet. So sustainability is certainly election cycle change that, if you think about what you referenced, climate funding for climate smart ag, a lot of ag companies, suppliers were adopting climate smart programs. some based upon that money. Farmers were beginning to say, okay, maybe some of these programs could pay. I might want to do this, and it may work for me. And some of that has changed, but what hasn't changed is the interest in soil health has continued to grow. You know, Indiana is a big leader in that. We're one of the biggest states that has adopted, sustainable, we call them sustainable ag today, but we would all call them conservation practices.
Mm-hmm.
We're a big adopter of that in this state in general. So that stuff has not changed. I think piqued interest in that, you know, developing more solutions for that on the end of suppliers and developing more financial opportunities for farmers, that's grown. Now, who's going to pay for it? And what part of the supply chain does the revenue come from? I think that's still definitely, from my desk, in the adaptation, not quite in the adaptation place. But I don't think the door shut on it just because the political winds changed some. I think it makes it, frankly, more relevant. You know, if these kind of programs can't stand without a government program, why are we doing them? I mean, that's not sustainable.
Yeah, well said. That's right.
How do you keep companies engaged? Because like I said, we're kind of in the bottom of that curve right now. And so, and maybe as you see leadership changes in companies and different things, how do you keep them engaged and looking to the future? Because it would be real easy to make a short-term decision and just say, hey, we're going to cut this out.
It'd be real easy to make a short-term decision and say, we're going to cut this out, because you guys tell me, you listen to the economists. I just talked to a very astute and good friend yesterday and said, we're probably in maybe year three of maybe a 6-year economic downturn in agriculture. We're all looking at that. We recognize it. So then if you're an ag supplier company and maybe a global company, this could be a real easy time to make a cut on a program that hasn't proven itself yet, couldn't it?
Yeah.
And it might even still make sense. And we've seen some cuts in that type of stuff this year. So how do you keep them engaged? I think, for one thing, it's driven by demand. Do growers demand this? Do they want these programs? I mean, I think that's one of the questions companies ought to be asking their customers is, you know, farmers, is this something that we need to do? Do we need to continue to stand this up? Do you want to adopt these things? Do you want to get paid? Do you want to make the changes that are out there? So for me, that's probably the first place I would start is the voice of their customer.
And I think they've shown that they do have an interest, but mm-hmm. it's got to be something they can make a short term. They like flexibility, right? I mean,
yes.
You know, if we believe that 60% of the acres or more is rented on most farms and higher in some areas, you know, they want mm-hmm. to do something that they can make a short-term impact and in a practice or a product or a tillage system and make an impact and be paid or at least offset the cost or maybe incentivize for it. And they want it to be simple. I think that in the early days of this sustainable path that everybody was on, a lot of folks were trying to get between the grower and the money, right? I mean, the person that had the, you know, that wanted to prioritize and wanted to spend and incentivize, there was a lot of folks between them and the grower. And I think the market's kind of figuring that out now.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I think that lends a point to something that I've always felt strongly about, and maybe it's the traditional ag background that I've had, like many of you. I do not think these things can be successful without engaging trusted suppliers. You know, there were companies that originally wanted to come out of Silicon Valley and just come to the farmer and say, hey, you guys, I got this for you, you better sign up. And that they weren't met with the most warm reception necessarily. And part of that is they tried to circumvent organizations like Premier, or whatever, the trusted supplier. You guys have the trust, and so does this system. And we can all talk about there's problems with systems and whatever, but I'm not here to do that today. The fact is, farmers rely on those trusted providers that they can work with, that they know, that they meet every day in their community, that they can call when they truly have help, need help. And if you try to circumvent that, I don't think that programs are successful. So that really has been one of the things in the consulting work I've done the last 4 years in the area. I always tell those organizations, you know, don't be doing that. And then back to Jeff's question, like, how do you engage them? I think creative partnerships is going to have to be something moving forward. A lot of companies want only this piece of the pie. So I'm going to own all of this space, and I'm going to own that farmer relationship, just like we just talked and tried to get in between the farmer and the money. And I don't think that's going to work either. I think, you know, making sure the partnerships are there, maybe it takes three or four different kinds of organizations to put together a basic, simple program that pays. I don't know. I don't design those programs, but I like you, I've seen some work and some not. And so it will have to be different than the original initial models, I think.
Yeah. You've got to, I know you've got some farmer focus groups that you work with. What, when you talk to those individual farmers, what are their, how do they sum up, you know, the sustainability piece? I mean, what are they looking for? I mean, I think some companies are scared to go out and ask that question because they don't fully understand it.
Yeah.
So if you could tell the companies, hey, here's the farmers I talk to, and you've got some progressive ones of all different sizes. What's the message the farmers giving so that maybe these companies would get some confidence to go ask that question and start that partnership you're talking about?
Yeah. I think the message is that they are interested, because progressive growers, and you hit it, Jeff, no matter what size they are, there's great progressive, successful growers. I can think of one right now that's 2,000 acres, but he doesn't rent anything. His model is very simple, but it works and it's profitable. There's really large growers too on the other side of things. They want to scale. That's their model. Doesn't matter. The answer is, when I lead those peer groups, I always try to bring in different speakers with even some weird ideas, because they love exploring the ideas. Now, doesn't mean they're not going to hit those providers back and say, here's what works, here's what doesn't, here's what I can adopt, and here's what I can't. And they know their own systems, their own labor, their own resources. But if you have individuals who are progressive, no matter what size, they know they have to continue to think differently, to learn something new, to make that operational change just ever so much every year, so that they do have the ability to continue to be in business when we are looking at a downturn like we're in right now. Your commodity prices are not what anybody wants to see. So if you bring them innovation and demonstrate how it pays and how it can work without such a disruption to their entire business model, then you have an open door.
That's good. I think there's companies out there that sit around and meet, but they have not done what you said. Go talk to the customer and ask him.
Yeah, they'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They sure will tell you.
Sarah Beth, let's change gears just a little bit. So much of what you've done has been kind of coaching along and bringing along kind of the next, and say the next generation. You've already mentioned that you're getting some alumni awards now and a few things like that. Where do you think the leadership gap is, I guess, in what way with this, the next, I hate to say the Gen Zs, or, you know, I hate to say those terms, but in that group of younger folks that are coming, and I'll sound like an old fogey, but so much that they just don't know, that was a lot of farm knowledge whenever we grew up, but a lot of these kids aren't from the farm. And that's part of our employee pool today. So where do you think the leadership gap will be with some of this next generation that's coming?
It's such a good question. And no matter what age you are, you need leadership. You know, even those of us who are seasoned in our careers, we still look to leaders, whether it's, maybe it's not your boss, because maybe you are the boss, but there's always another leader that you're looking to. Yep. So we all need that. So first, I want to say, I don't want to sound like the old person to the young people if they're listening, because we need leaders too, even if we have a lot of years of career under our belt, and that we all have to have motivation, inspiration, direction, examples of success, encouragement, whatever leaders do. But there is an interesting gap that I feel strongly that I think you hit on, Sal. You and I would agree on this, and it's two parts. One is the ag knowledge, and the other is a different mindset of expectation of when they're ready. And I'll explain that. The ag knowledge you hit on. I mean, as we graduate individuals in ag colleges that don't have farm backgrounds, but have an interest in agriculture because they came to it through an urban program, or maybe it's FFA and they had the neat opportunity to do that, even if they didn't have a farm degree, or they're just looking at the science and they really think the science is cool. And I see a lot of kids getting interested in agriculture because of that. But the gap in farm knowledge, it's difficult the only way to really help that, and, you know, ag people, we can be real snobbish about ag knowledge. I mean, I work with a consultant in an ag company. I never thought I'd
hear that, but that is exactly true.
Oh, my
true.
Gosh, but yeah. We are, Sal. Yeah. So let me give you this. So I work with a consultant in an ag company. He was working on ag issues, been in ag 30 years, but no farm background. And he and I were talking one night. He said, you know, they smell it on me. When I go into a meeting at like a co-op or something, and even though I've been in ag 30 years, they know I'm not from a farm. And he just said, he's real intimidated by it. And it was kind of funny, but we do feel that way. We talk about where'd you grow up and what did you show or what did you raise? Or for some of us, for a certain age, did you walk beans and detassel corn? You know, we use that language as a touch point. It's cultural. We cannot make that cultural connection with those young people that we hire who have no ag background. It is not there. We cannot make it. I think the closest thing we can do for that leadership gap is to take up a mantle of mentorship. And so we do want to show them the value of the things that we know. Hard work, that technology is great, but understanding the land and understanding animals and understanding the cycles and seasons is important to really doing the job well. So if you can associate them with mentors that do have that, just, you know, in some ways we call it institutional, but we would really call it lifestyle ag knowledge, maybe there's a help there from a leadership standpoint. The second question on young people and what's the leadership gap is, I find this sometimes when I employ younger folks, is that, and I know we're all, when we're young, we're all giddy to do something more. And then all of a sudden, one day you look around, you're like, I really wish I wasn't old. It's not so great. But when you're young, you want to be older, right? Which is so funny. When you get older, you're like, that was really a stupid notion. But I'll hire, you know, young folks, and I had one young gal, she was doing a good job until this. And it was 3 months in, doing a great job now. 3 months. She said, well, I wanted to have her do something else, and she didn't want to do it. She's like, well, I've been here 3 months, Sarah. I know as much as you know now about your business.
Oh.
And I wasn't, you know, you can't even be mad. It's so ludicrous. But I think that the point of that is not to take away from that person. It's sometimes we see folks that they want to achieve, and they have an earnest desire. I like that, right? We want motivated and ambitious people, but as a lack of sensitivity to recognize that you really have a lot more you have to know in order to take those leadership steps, and you do need more leadership. So if we can partner them with those mentors, I think that's a chance for us to really bridge those gaps.
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. I was just thinking about some of those students that when I go to these career fairs, when they come through, they are very, very sharp. They are mm-hmm. polished. They're way ahead of the curve when mm-hmm. I was that age. I mean, I couldn't even keep up with these kids. But like I said, a lot of them lack the on-farm experience. And that's funny that you said that you know, we are a little bit snobbish. And because if you didn't cut Jimson weed out of beans, I mean, you know, how can you even be an ag?
Yeah.
And so that's but they are very, very sharp, very polished. They have the people skills. And like I said, I mm-hmm. think we mentor them and help them through that experience gap that maybe they have. You know, think about it. You know, we had that. We weren't quite as polished when we were coming out of school. Myself, I can't speak for you, Sal. Oh. You were probably polished. And but we made it. And so I think that's a great thing to, especially for those young people, to seek out those good mentors, not just wait for them to come to you. Go find a mentor.
Yeah, totally agree. I really do. Finding a mentor has always been rewarding.
Yeah, I've never thought about it until Sarah Beth was saying it. But, you know, I think it's beyond just cultural about a farm experience. When you grow up, it becomes a credibility check, and you don't even know you're consciously doing it. But, you know, do we listen for the cues? Like, yeah, I did. I know what Jimson weed is. I used to hack it down all summer. Well, that, you know, is that a credibility point? And it's not always the case. I mean, we can have like and parallel careers and not have all the past experiences.
What, when you talk to your farm groups, where are they at in terms of getting their kids to come back to the farm?
Oh, yeah. Such a great question. So Jeff represents farm groups. I've led several farm peer groups over the years. At one time I had four, but I led those under another brand, under a brand. And today that brand went away. They stopped doing them. The one of the groups that was under that brand said, came to me and said, we want to stay together. And that was 15 years ago. So I've had this one peer group for 15 years. We actually have our quarterly call tomorrow. I know. And I've always thought there'd be a point when they're like, well, we're done, but they aren't. It's a band of brothers and sisters now, and they really are. And, you know, what are they talking about bringing people back? Well, because they've been together this long, we've seen everybody's personal cycles. You've seen marriages, deaths, births,
change.
Lots of good stuff and lots of hard things. And I think the most important, consistent message that I see those groups sharing with one another as they meet a new a peer that's son or daughter is coming back. And today daughters are coming back. That's also a very different thing, because that's not just, well, the, you know, when we were kids, dads didn't necessarily not want us to be interested, but it wasn't assumed that the daughter was going to come back. Now, today's parents are saying, well, which one of you wants to come back, or can everybody come back, and what are the roles? And that's pretty cool too. But I think the big thing is work off the farm. If I were to paraphrase that advice, and people do it in differing degrees and for a different number of years, and some circumstances mean you have to come back. Something happens, you need to get back and help, and it just turns into a job. But working off the farm is one of the most consistent messages I hear the peer group farmers advising each other about, because I don't advise them. They advise each other. You know, I'm holding the space and doing a few things, but there's a lot of value in that, because of it. First of all, it helps with a bunch of those assumptions that, you know, it's just going to, and it's really hard to the maturity curve when you go straight from college back to farm, and then all of a sudden you're back in mom and dad's house, but you're supposed to work there, but are you an employee? Or are you a partner? Are you still a kid? Like, it's a mess. And it's so, working through that is also one of the really interesting challenges. And just giving that time is definitely a couple of those succession conversations we have.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, Sarah Beth, what's next? I mean, what is next for you and all of your everything that you've got going on? So what are some of the projects that you've got coming up that you're excited about?
Well, one important project that we just kicked off, I think you might find it very interesting, is under the advocacy brand. And so we, as I mentioned earlier, we started a lot of that work around this climate, carbon, sustainability, what should we do there space. And as I said earlier, that awareness is already there. What's really hot for us now is what we broadly would refer to as land use. And rural ag land use. And so I just started another, we're calling it a council, but it's really a loose alliance and a set of roundtables. We're calling it simply Rural Land Use and Siting Council. We had our first meeting up at the Indiana Farm Bureau offices last Thursday, as of this time of recording. And what that's about is to bring together four critical stakeholders on a continual conscious basis to really talk about and sort out what on earth we're doing around land use, because land use has become so divisive. You know, so those stakeholders are farmers and rural landowners, developers, and originally I was thinking just renewable energy developers, but we have a lot of land use issues depending on the county you live in, that, you know, development of housing and commercial and retail is more of a pressure than solar or wind ever is going to be. Yeah. And then you've got your data center stuff that's coming into the conversation. You've got your local elected officials who, not so awful long ago, many of those in very, very rural areas, their biggest concern was the, you know, getting a bridge fixed and making sure we had good roads. And I'm not simplifying their jobs, but they were simpler than they have become. And now these folks are charged with multi-generational, multi-million dollar decisions for their communities, for the greater good, and what a hard job. And so we are now fielding that effort to just begin this, just really open up a dialogue and get those people together. And one interesting fact too, that it's tough, but it's a fact, is land, you know, farmers, we aren't all lumped in the same point of view around land use either. So a lot of developers look at, well, you ag people think this. Well, boy, they couldn't be more wrong, right? Some farmers are very excited about their renewable energy and their solar project, and they're making a decision to get paid very well to develop land, and other farmers simply do not hold that same opinion and maybe don't have that same opportunity. So it's a real contentious topic. I tend to find myself in the middle of those things. I'm not really sure why, but that's just a role God has decided I need to play. So I'll do it. But that's a big issue we're going to tackle here in the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just attended a local economic development banquet, like their annual banquet for a local county. And went through there. They had a great keynote speaker, and everybody got up and they gave their awards to different businesses, and they talked about projects and things that they're looking at. And it was all around infrastructure, businesses that they're wanting to come in there, housing, you know, to be able to bring, if you bring business in, you got to have housing for the employees, stuff like that. But there, the thing that was missing in the room is there was nobody there to represent agriculture. The farmers weren't there. The ag businesses weren't there. And I sit there and I think about, especially some of these rural counties and how big a portion of, you know, that county is made up of agriculture, and they're not in those rooms. They're thinking about other things. And that was the comment, you know, the conversation with my wife and I on the way home. It's like, ag's missing from this picture.
Yeah.
And I think ag has a great role to play in the economic development of a county, but we need a seat at the table. And I don't know exactly how we get there. I think we've got to put ourselves in the room.
I think Sarah Beth's probably right in the middle of this one, is that just trying to get ag as an acre of ag tillable land at not classified as non-developed or.
Oh, I know.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
So this acre of land that's productive on it and gives a return every year, but that's undeveloped, right? And you wonder, and I think these things, Sarah Beth, go back to the property tax system that we've got in Indiana that nobody will touch with a 10-foot pole. And
no kidding.
And that goes back to what Jeff just said about, you know, housing. We've got people that want to move into these areas and work in ag businesses and attend different schools, or they're mobile enough, they want to get out of Chicago. But every time a piece of land sells, the first thing we do is doze the house down. And because we sure don't want to pay taxes on that. And we don't want to deal with renters or whatever, right? So we doze it down and we farm over it. And but that's one thing we're missing in the landscape now, is just a lot of the old farmhouses that used to be around. You know, they just get pushed in.
We actually worked with a guy, and his father-in-law, big farmer in another area, and they refer to him as dozer houses.
Oh my god.
So you buy a farm, it's got a dozer house on it, and that means you're going to push it down.
Yeah. Boy, that's true. It's interesting what you say about that. And, you know, your comment about how ag land is undeveloped land. I mean, if I don't know if developers of any kind listen to your podcast, I'll put it on my social, so some may pick it up when we put this thing out. But if they're listening, I mean, talk about the fastest way to tick off in a bad way a potential landowner that you want to engage in development, whether it's, I don't care what it is, solar, wind, a project. If you send them a letter, and I've seen these letters that say, hey, Mr. Jarrett, would you like to get paid for your undeveloped land?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? This is a business. You know, this land is in development. It is in production. I mean, what a joke, but that's just the type of thing that, so like I said, if you're developing, you're listening, don't do that.
Guy just spent $1,000 an acre developing that ground all year.
Every year.
Yes. They've spent a lot of money developing it. Your customers know. They send you some of that money to begin to develop that land on a year-to-year basis.
I guess we're developers. Premier Ag.
Never thought of it that way.
Yeah. There you go, Jeff.
Well, Jeff, I don't know. I know we sure have a lot more we could talk about.
We could go on for.
But we got to have her back again, and we got to have at least something out there. Sarah Beth, is there anything you wanted to cover before we hop off again before we have you back for the next time?
Well, I would love to come back, so you can consider that a yes. And I thank you for the pre offer. But I think the last thing I would say is, I'll go back to what Jeff said. It's a good place to jump off here, to step off stage, and that is, if the issue is important enough to you, your livelihood, your next generation, in agriculture, we have to be at the table. Like he was talking with that economic meeting, where are the landowners? And so, you know, in all the work I've done, a through line for me has always been the farmer, the landowner, that their perspective's got to be at the center of that discussion and at the center of that set of decision making. And that's just really important to me. It always has been. And so, you know, if you're we have to make time for it. It's really hard to make time for those things. We have other things to do, but it's important to the landowners and farmers out there. We've got a lot of critical stuff happening in our ecosystem right now, and we do have to take a leadership role, and that often falls to the individual to make the decision to step up and speak up for their farm and their industry.
What did you say? Somebody needs to do something. I better get busy, or how did you put it?
Yes, forget. Yeah. I did say that.
Yeah.
All right. So next time we get together, let's do it in person. We'll make it a wine and cheese party, and we'll just have wine and cheese in the podcast room, and we'll just go from there.
That'll be an interesting podcast.
It would be.
Yes. I think it sounds great. I'll bring it. I'll be the one who supplies that.
Perfect.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Sarah Beth. We appreciate your insight and all the all the work that you've done bringing these coalitions together. And I think that's one of your definite skills is just bringing folks together just to have a group that's been together for 15 years. You know, a lot of relationships don't last that long, and to get a group of people to stay together and through that many changes in business and lives, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it's a good group. All right. So thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks. And that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.